The Farming Programme with Arroquip Steel Stockholders, Withambrook Industrial Estate Grantham. For all your steel needs, call their friendly experts.
Should you be spraying now? Should you be planting yet? Agronomist Sean Sparling has some key advice.
If you tip your head on its side at canopy levelling, you see those buds rising above that canopy, then you're too late.
We'll talk about some opportunities from agricultural transition, future farm funding, and hear about a local company's innovation in farming machine parts manufacture.
So we've taken a part which they've identified that there's wear issues, very costly. We deconstruct it and make a part which is going to last longer.
And of course, we'll see how the markets are performing and what the weather holds in store for us this week.
The Week in Agriculture. This is The Farming Programme with Steve Orchard.
Hello, this is The Farming Programme podcast for March the 17th, 2024. Hope you've had a good week. I'm Steve Orchard. In the news this week, research by Rothamsted shows that blackgrass adapts to flourish even when soil is saturated for up to 3 weeks, unlike wheat growth and well-drained grass. The research also showed that the more herbicide-resistant the blackgrass was, the more waterlogging-tolerant it was too. Other studies have shown that weed competition early in crop development has the greatest impact on yield. Rothamsted also said that sugar beet growers could face a virus epidemic on the scale of 2020 this year, with aphids flying 2 to 3 weeks earlier than average. And don't forget, as reported last week on the Farming Programme, the use of Cruiser SB on seed has been approved for this year by DEFRA. A report from Durham University indicates that organised crime, including those linked to the international drugs trade, is behind much of the growing incidence of rural crime. We'll talk more about this with the CLA on next week's Farming Programme. DEFRA has published data showing that dairy farm income may have fallen by as much as 78% in the year to February 2024, with cereal businesses seeing a 77% drop. There were large drops in the income for cropping enterprises and mixed farms, a tiny increase for grazing livestock, but an increase of a third for specialist pig enterprises. However, that comes off the back of a torrid past few years. I don't think those figures will come as a great surprise. The window for claims for existing countryside stewardship and environmental stewardship agreements opened on Friday. You have to submit an annual declaration or claim before the 15th of May to receive full payment for actions carried out in 2024. Any claims submitted after this date and up to the final deadline of the 2nd of September will have a late claim reduction applied to payments. How annoying is it when a part breaks on a machine? Usually in the middle of a field, in the rain, when you're already running late. Long-established Lincoln-based parts business Spaldings have been innovating to produce replacement wear parts in-house. How does that benefit you? I went along to Sadler Road to have a look and started with a chat with CEO Paul Bray.
Paul, we've been looking at the process for making parts, but I want to take a step back, if we may, because it's not just with Spaldings a case of a part on a piece of farming equipment's broken, produce me a new one.
Yeah.
Your innovation and the way you've looked at this is taking that a stage further to produce something that could well be better for the farmer than the bit that's broken.
Yeah. There's less people on farm, so farmers want parts which are going to last longer. So we've taken a part which they've identified that there's wear issues, very costly. We deconstruct it and make a part which is going to last longer.
Okay, and that part might be different to the original or different material. What are you actually coming up with?
We take samples of a part from all over the country because it still wears differently depending on what soils type you've got. We analyse the wear on that particular part. And then we come up with a design which compensates for those wear points on that particular part.
And this innovation comes at a cost. I mean, the equipment that you've got to produce this stuff ain't going to be cheap.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we don't consider ourselves just as a spare part stockist. We pride ourselves that we design, innovate, and we've invested thousands. The machinery sitting here has cost us $35,000.
And what's the key requirement of a farmer? Something breaks on a machine, is it the downtime? Is it the cost of the part itself?
I would say now it's downtime. Machinery is getting bigger. Changing points on a machine which has got 30, 40, 50 tines on a machine, it's quite a lengthy process to change those parts. So we're trying to design a part which is going to outlast the part that it came with originally.
And of course, what a farmer doesn't want is this very expensive large piece of machinery sat there for days while the new part's got to come in from wherever in the world.
It's a very narrow window, particularly with you see changes in climate. Yeah, that window between harvest and cultivation has got shorter and shorter. So, you know, people don't want to stand, you know, they don't want guys in a workshop changing parts.
Aidan Wells, product engineer at Spalding's. Getting wear parts produced by your method is more than just copying the old one, isn't it? There's no calipers here to do the measurement. So how does it all work?
Yeah, having the scanner, the 3D scanner allows us to the starting process of reverse engineering, so taking the OEM parts or original parts that the customer's wanting. The scanner allows us to scan that to a detail of, I think it's 0.01 millimetres. So we really ensure where bolt holes are and arcs and mating faces, that they are absolutely critically bang on to what the OEM part is, the ones that they're used to getting. We want them to fit, our products to fit just as the ones they've had previously. So it starts with the scanning where it takes thousands of little points. We use the scanning data to build upon when we come to our concept design.
So on the desk, we've got a part that's coming from a farmer. Lots of dots all over it that wouldn't normally be there. So what's the process now? You've had the part from the farmer that you need to replicate. What are you going to do?
So, it'd start with customer feedback, really, is where it comes from. Farmers saying they're not getting what they want out of it, the prices they're paying, they're having to change them far too often. And then that's when we can kind of come and say, well, okay, what would you be willing to kind of look to pay? What are you wanting to get out of it? You want it to last all season? Are you changing them daily? Let's make that weekly. It kind of all depends on that pricing point as well, how much materials we use. So it's just balancing up the wear to the pounds per acreage, really, and where balancing that out.
So as you say, it's a balance between what the farmer wants, what they're prepared to pay, how long they want it to last for, and so on. Now, this particular part is covered in little dots. What do they do?
Yeah, so they're for the 3D scanner, so they're where it knows in 3D space. As we scan the top of the product, and then we want to go get the reverse on the flip side to make sure it knows, then as it follows it round, to make sure it's a smooth scan and it's all amalgamated together. Once I've scanned that and I flip it over, I could then flip it back to that side and it'll automatically realise, I've scanned this piece already. I know all them dots in a 3D environment, that pattern in a 3D world where they all are. At the moment it looks random, but to the scanner then no other pattern can be like that because all them dots are in their own unique position.
And is that because you've got a complicated shaped part here? It's curved, it's got bits sticking up in different places, it's got holes in different places. Must be very difficult to measure in the traditional way.
Yeah, using calipers and stuff, measuring, especially on a lot of chisel point cultivators, it's kind of hard to get the mating back faces without having all the time having the parts they fit on, which sometimes isn't always a luxury we have. So we find this has been the most dimensionally accurate way of getting that information.
So having scanned the original part, you can sort of manipulate the image to correct faults and maybe make the finished new part better?
Once we finally rebuilt up the product where we want it to be and what we see is the design. So again, studying wear patterns from up and down the country, from speaking to the customers, we then know where to put the precious metals, extra hard facing, extra steel to avoid those early issues or to solve those pain points or inefficiencies in a product that customers are seeing. So then once we finalise the design, we're happy with it, we want to go back out to see the customers, we'll print off some prototypes. Sometimes we do even a few different ones, say, okay, how do you like the look of this one? How does this one look? How do these ones vary in fitment or perhaps different concepts? Sometimes we do split one product down into two. So if you see heavier wear at the bottom third, sometimes we'll make that bottom third a replaceable part rather than it being the whole thing is replaceable, because that makes more efficient and out of it and a better cost of time. So 3D printing for the prototype inside has been great.
The 3D printer prints a plastic equivalent of the final part.
The final part, yeah.
Then somewhere that's got to be turned into something metal.
Yes, it has. And then that's where we take the same 3D print that we'll send to prototype in here, and then what we visit the customers with, we can then send off to our suppliers around the country, around the world. We've got a few different ones. We do tend to lean on the ones over in China. They've got kind of better process, and it's really come a long way, that industry, recently, especially with their quality processes. Whereas this is now, it's very much designed in the UK for UK farmers, but it is built abroad, but we control how things are, where things go, the how well it's casted, the machining levels it's down to, and why that is. So we completely dictate the production of it.
It was fascinating to see the process at Spalding's. Thanks for showing me around, guys. Some impressive use of innovation. And if you want to know more, there's videos and loads of information at spaldings.co.uk. To the fields now, still with his waterproofs on. Will they ever come off? Our crop doctor, Sean Sparling. Morning, Sean.
Yes, morning, Steve. It's really quite frustrating now, isn't it? You know, lovely drying day last Saturday, just when you start to think it could be on the change, and then we get more rain. Getting on for another inch in most places, and more than that since we last spoke. So very little change out here in terms of the drilling situation, but things are now starting to move thanks to that return to temperatures in the low to mid-teens by day and the higher single figures generally by night. And soil temperatures now in the mid to high sevens too. So they're slowly responding to that ambient temperature change. And because of that lack of activity out in the field, just like Wardy, I'm going to try and be short and sweet this week. Those people lucky enough to have good oilseed rape, it's really motoring now. Looking better by the day in the main, or rather as well as it can look, because even the good bits look a bit thin and spindly to me this time of year. They always do. But the buds are now starting to rise clear of these canopies, in the more forward stuff in particular. Not quite green bud, but that's only a week or 10 days away in those bits. Stem extension upon us then in the forward and some of the backward bits alike. So planning your final nitrogen application is going to be important. Leave it as late as you can on the more forward bits. Do the calculations on what the crop requires, and particularly if you've only just put that first 100 kilos or so on the crop. So as long as you can still get a decent spread pattern, the crop's not too high for you to go through, you'll be fine. The more backward stuff, you've obviously got much more time in those pieces. And with the buds now rising clear of the canopy, that's an important milestone for herbicide applications in oilseed rape. If you look down from above the canopy and the buds are still enclosed and below that canopy level, you're probably still okay for clopyrrolid, picloram, haloxifen, methyl. But if you tip your head on its side at canopy level and you see those buds rising above that canopy, then you're too late. Clopyrrolid on its own, possibly slightly more forgiving, but any real movement of the buds upwards and you shouldn't be putting herbicides on. There's a real risk of crop damage if you do, so you've been warned. Light leaf spot levels increasing too in these warming conditions, so keep an eye on that as things warm up. A few more warm days like we're getting now and the light leaf spot will really start to motor. It's already moving and starting to change, particularly where no fungicide's been applied as yet, and even where it has, you've only got 3 weeks protection, of course. So stick a few leaves in a polythene bag with a bit of damp kitchen roll, pop it in a warm dark place, and if there's light leaf spot in those leaves, you'll see the characteristic milk spot start to appear within 24, 48 hours. I'm not going to tell you to put the bag in the airing cupboard, because the younger boss's son on one of my farms said to me the other day, well, it's an airing cupboard, which made me feel really old. So I suggested he pop it in a similarly warm, dark place, and I wandered off. Plenty of yellow and brown rust visible now. Brown rust showing up in winter barley, just as it is in winter wheat. So people starting to think about T0s, believe it or not. I think it's too early yet. And because I've yet to see growth stage 30 widespread in the main stem, that's when leaf 4 emerges, let alone in the lead tiller, even in my September drill pieces, I'm trying to hold out for a couple more weeks if I can. T0 these days is all about correcting deficiencies of manganese, magnesium, sulfur, zinc, copper, and trying to hold on to yellow rust in particular. That's the priority, along with trying to boost your root biomass after the last 6 months of the wet stuff and these leach depleted soils they're trying to grow in. So growth stage 30, a very important growth stage to identify in cereals for several crop safety reasons. So it's important you get that right. For example, you can't put most formulations of tebuconazole on before growth stage 30. You can't put more than 1.3 litres of chlormoquat chloride on before growth stage 30. You can't put Trinexpac ethyl or Modus type products on before growth stage 30. So it's incredibly important you understand that growth stage. Growth regulators in particular applied before growth stage 30 at routinely robust or incorrect doses on cereals at that time and can seriously compromise the formation of the tillers and the ears and therefore crop yield. So obviously you won't see any visible signs of that damage in the crop until you put the combine in the field. So when the distance from the top of the basal node to the tip of the ear is 1 centimetre, that's growth stage 30. And look for it on the lead tiller, because then most of the field is going to be there too. There'll be all manner of snake oils and products touted that are going to claim to be able to reverse the effects of the 26 weeks of wet weather we've had, the 28 inches or so we've had in that 26 weeks. All sorts of strange amino acids and biologicals to recycle waste product bacterial soups. But there's no such thing as a miracle cure. So look at the trials data very closely and pick the products that have independently verified trials data. Walk a mile away from the ones that have one trial that's proving its worth, because the chances are there are going to be 100 more that didn't prove its worth in those cases. No sugar beet in yet, no peas, spring beans, spring oats, very few spring beans, very little spring wheat. a few bits of spring barley in on the lighter land, but only a fraction in that's going in. And with soils still as wet as they are, we desperately need some drying, warming weather to let us at least think we can get on. Now, I know things are tough out there, and I know how worrying it all is with the weather and the prices such as they are. But just want to say, however fed up you get and however worried you feel, please make sure you keep talking to people, and at the very least moaning at your agronomist on a weekly basis, a problem shared and all that. It's never an imposition to talk about your concerns with your agronomist. Don't hold it in. Dad used to say it's better out than in, although to be fair, I don't think he was referring to his worries. But all joking apart, it really is incredibly important that you tell someone how you're feeling if it's starting to get on top of you, and that you keep talking to your friends, your neighbours, your agronomist, your family. It's amazing how helpful it can be just to talk about it. Plus, of course, there are those wonderful people at the Lincolnshire Rural Support Network who can and will help you if you're feeling down about the situation. You can speak to them in total confidence on their helpline, which is 0800 138 1710, or just Google LRSN. They're part of the Farming Community Network. But most importantly in all of this, just remember that you are not on your own, and there is always somebody to talk to. Ring me if you want. I'm always happy to talk. Right, that'll do. Not sure how I had so little to say, but I've still managed to talk for about 6 minutes. So let's pray for some dry, warm weather. Let's see what the next 7 days bring.
Thanks as ever, Sean. Coming up, we're looking at the opportunities from agricultural transition, future farm funding, land and food security, plus the markets and the weather for the week to come.
The Farming Programme with Araquip Steel Stockholders, with Withambrook Industrial Estate Grantham, supplying the region for over 40 years.
This is the Farming Programme podcast. I'm Steve Orchard. Last week, Savills Rural Team hosted a series of breakfast meetings, very tasty, thank you Doddington Hall, looking at the state of the market and some opportunities and funding potential. After the meeting, I had a chat with a couple of the presenters, firstly Georgina Sweeting, who I asked about the Capital Grant Scheme and the Future Farming Resilience Fund. But first, Georgina, there are many, many, 50 of them, new options being introduced this summer in SFI. Are there any particular ones coming up that you think will spark interest?
Yeah, so I suppose there are a couple of really easy wins, so to speak. So you've got an option for applying fertiliser with a variable rate applicator, which will appeal to quite a lot of arable farmers, and that's £27 per hectare. A lot of people are either doing that already, or they do have the capability to be able to do that.
Is the intention of that to try and use less fertiliser?
I think it's a bit of both. So it's to use less fertiliser, but also to ensure that wherever you are putting the fertiliser, it's where it's really needed. You're not just blanket spreading a field. You're kind of targeting the areas where it really, it matters. So it's more precise, it's more efficient, which will help save cost and then reduce the usage overall.
Okay.
And then I suppose the other option that seems fairly popular, depending on land type, is the no-till option. So I think it's around £73 per hectare for using no-till techniques for establishment of crops, which is quite substantial.
As you say, that is largely land dependent. That's not going to work where the land's too heavy and so on. There are incentives for cover crops as well, aren't there?
Yes. So in the current iteration of the scheme, you've got the incentive for overwinter cover crops. And then going forward, we'll also have a spring and summer version as well. Not quite sure what it'll look like, but it's basically a multi-species cover crop of some description.
Now, these are, as you say, all come into force in the summer. And like I say, I don't propose that we go through all of them. That's why that would take up the entire programme, basically. But is there somewhere that farmers can go to find out the detail on all this?
So the RPA they've done a blog. So on the blog, you've got the headline figures and the title of each option. But we yet to have the actual nitty-gritty and the key requirements of each option. So hopefully that will come.
Now, this seemed to be the state of affairs previously, didn't it? That it, you know, they announced things and then it took ages before we actually got the detail to be able to say, yes, that's for me, or no, it isn't.
Exactly. And it's what we're seeing again under this iteration of the scheme. I think they were quite keen to get something out at the beginning of the year to show that it is progressing and it is moving on and it's been built on constantly. But we could really do with just a bit more information behind the titles, really, just so clients can make an informed decision now rather than it getting to harvest and all of a sudden they're having to think about this as well.
Yeah, so there's enough going on there then anyway, isn't there? There's a couple of potential sources of grant money, I guess, that I'd like you to give us a bit more detail on if you can. One is the Capital Grant Scheme.
Yep. So the capital grant scheme was previously part of Countryside Stewardship, and it's now standalone, and it is open year round, and essentially it pays for a programme of capital works on your farm. So whether that be hedgerow creation, you could get funding to plant a new hedgerow, or fencing. So whether that would be to fence off a watercourse or another environmental feature. And there's also grants for stonewalling. So it's very much farm specific, but it's in theory meant to be a simpler application process, and it's open year round. So you could say apply now for a hedging programme that would start at the back end.
And the other one was the Future Farming Resilience Fund. Now, that, you could look at that in a million different ways, really, couldn't you? Resilience, future farming. What's that all about?
So the Future Farming Resilience Fund is essentially a pot of money that DEFRA have set aside to help farmers through the agricultural transition period. And a number of providers across the country have been allocated so many visits, per se, of businesses. So we are a provider of the FFRF, and you can go out on farm, and the client has to have received the BPS. So I suppose it's purely for people that would have received BPS, and it's looking at how their business can move forward. So we're seeing a lot of people using it for things such as budgeting and cash flows to see how the decline of BPS will impact them going forward. But also people are using it now to look at the sustainable farming incentive, because I think it works quite nicely. We've got all this new scheme coming out, and it's quite complicated. There's a lot of pages, there's a lot going on. So it gives people the opportunity to have a consultant out for half a day to look around their farm, go away, and then come back with some ideas of what may or may not work. So it's proving quite popular.
And that consultant would come, in your case, from Savills, and therefore the fund is paying your fee, yeah?
Yeah, for sure. So we have teamed up with NIAB and a consultancy firm called the AKC. So you would sign up, and you would say if you wanted someone from Savills, or if you're more into soil, you might say, actually, I want someone from NIAB. We could come out, meet you, give you a report, and that is all funded by the FFRF. And then if we feel that you would benefit from more help or some additional funding, we can then give you an additional day and a half as well. So if it was to look into something quite specific on your farm, we have the option to kind of extend the time allocation.
I love the way you called the FFRF. That must have taken some practice.
I think I've been talking about it for over a year. It's a bit snappier than the Future Farming Resilience Fund.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it, really? Would somebody who's interested in this, who thinks this may be relevant for them, come to you at Savills, or is there somewhere central to get information?
So if you just Google, I think it's Savills FFRF, it's the top link, and it comes up with free business support for farmers. And then you can go on there and register. So as I say, you have to have previously received BPS, and you can't register for multiple providers.
And just to add to the confusion, there is another new fund, isn't there? Or reopened fund.
It's all a bit of a minefield, isn't it? The Farming Equipment and Technology Fund has reopened again. And if you were looking at, say, applying for the Sustainable Farming Incentive, and you wanted that £27 per hectare top up for applying for variable rates, under the Farming Equipment and Technology Fund, you can receive funding for, say, an end sensor or a system that you could put onto your existing fertiliser drill to give it that capability to spread variable rate. So there is funding to help you upgrade.
Right. So this is aimed really at the tech side of farming, isn't it? Robotics and automation and so on.
Yeah, so it's aimed at more trying to improve efficiency and productivity. So under the latest round, one example is the computer for variable rate spreading and for seed applications. So that is aimed at your technology, improving that. But then also under the scheme, there's an option for CCTV on farm, digital weather stations. I looked at one today that was a drain jetter. So that's included this year. That's never been there before. I think a lot of people might be thinking about that one. And then it's also for livestock as well, so handling facilities, scales, that sort of thing.
Georgina Sweeting from Savills, thank you so much for joining us on the Farming Programme this morning.
Thank you for having me.
At the Savills breakfast meetings last week, Kelly Hewson-Fisher looked at some opportunities that might arise from the farming transition. We'll talk about that in a minute, but first, can we consider the land, or rather the potential lack of it, and food security? We have a growing population needing more land to live on and more food. And against that, we have encouragement to take land out of production in various ways. That seems to me, Kelly, for a recipe for a problem in years to come.
There's a really interesting statistic from a recent report by the Royal Society that said in order to meet our environmental targets, we would need an additional 10.8 million acres of land. So what you're saying, Steve, is right, that we seem to have a lot of demands from our land, but it is a finite resource. So how can we actually integrate and collaborate in order to achieve everything that we want to achieve, both from our environmental targets and ambitions through to food production? And as you say, with a growing population, there is a need for more development. From my perspective, certainly the answer to some of those conundrums is how we stack and bundle and sequence the options and the opportunities that are available. So where we can look to really have a holistic, integrated approach, which not only produces for food production, but also potentially for renewables and for the environment. So we can really start to see how everything can come together in an integrated approach where we can achieve what we need to achieve. And really, it's about doing so to build resilience into our businesses, to provide sustainability for the future, to provide thriving rural communities, and not forgetting that those businesses need to be profitable. So ensuring that actually there is a, you know, profitability centred within those conversations as well.
Because you talked about a food security index, a statutory food security index. What did you mean by that, and how's it going to work?
So the Prime Minister at the National Farmers Union conference recently stated the importance of food production in the UK. So he talked about food being a public good, and I think that's really important to look at that change in terminology that's been utilised and what does that actually mean. When we left the EU, we didn't have a food policy or a food strategy, and really looking at how the UK government is turning that round and what does that look like. He also made a statement that food security is national security. And in making that statement, he said that an annual food security index would be undertaken, and he would ensure that that would be laid down in statutory as a statutory instrument. I think what we need to see is the detail. So what does that actually entail? You know, the devil is always in the detail, but what does that actually entail? What does that mean? And what are the, you know, will there be any targets set, and what will that information do? What conversations will it be taken into, and what will be driven from that index? So I think there's more to wait and see in terms of the detail.
But it is an interesting, not necessarily a change, but maybe it is a change, I don't know, with the move from subsidies to payment for public good. And now he's saying food actually is a public good, because that's not been all that clear coming from government in recent years, has it?
I think it's a really interesting change of terminology being utilised. And as I say, I think it'll be really interesting how that actually plays out. What does that actually mean, that change in terminology? It's been really a grey area. Is food a private good? Is it something that we each individually consume and enjoy ourselves? Or is it a public good? So for the Prime Minister to actually confirm that it is a public good, I think it's quite interesting, as I say, how that will play out.
Yes, of course, we do have the prospect of a general election before too long. And I wonder whether, I mean, all the smart money, in inverted commas, is that we will have a government of a different hue in a few months' time. Not going to go there, but that seems to be the way all the surveys seem to be going. Do we know whether any other parties are viewing all this in the same way? Or are we going to have more big changes in a few months' time?
What's been interesting is all of the parties have certainly placed an importance on food production, and all of them at some point have referred to food production as or food security as national security. So I think that's really important that actually there is an emphasis on food production. I think, you know, historically there's a given that farmers produce food, and I think that can't be taken as granted because of the environmental ambitions and targets that are set, because of all of the other demands on land. So going forward, it's certainly going to be about government being able to drive that integrated approach so that we can actually achieve what we need to achieve from land.
We're in a big transition period. We have been for the last 2 or 3 years. That transition will continue for another 3 or 4 years.
Are there opportunities to be had in this transition?
As you said, we are going through a transition for agriculture. And what's interesting as well is that it's going through this transition in all of the devolved nations. So England, Northern Ireland, Wales and Scotland are all going through this transition. And I must say they're going through it at a different pace, and it will actually end up being quite different in all of the devolved nations. So that in itself is quite interesting. As you say, I think there are options and opportunities going forward. So there's certainly food production, and one of my top picks is certainly looking at prime arable land, specifically land with a secure and resilient access to supply to water. And all the challenges, you know, we can talk for days about the challenges facing the water sector. There is energy as well, and renewables, and our target to meet net zero emissions by 2050, 2045 in Scotland. There's all of our environmental targets. So we've got the Environment Act of 2021. We've got 30% of land and sea to be protected by 2030. We've got biodiversity net gain that came into play on the 12th of February. And then we've got additionality of nutrient neutrality and water neutrality, so homes and development and health as well, health and well-being. So looking at how social value really drives economic growth in those rural communities. We've got an awful lot going on there. And as I mentioned right at the beginning, you know, those options and opportunities are going to really drive that stacking, that bundling and the sequencing of that integrated approach for the future.
The one area that's close to your heart, you mentioned it just then, is water. We certainly do need somehow better water management, don't we? You know, we get too much of it, then 3 months later we've not got enough of it. We're surrounded by water. Why on earth can't we get this right?
We certainly need a holistic water management strategy. We need to look at water quality and water quantity. So when we are in times of drought or in times of flood, that we can better manage the water. And as you say, you know, when we are in those times of flood, it can cause, you know, sheer devastation is what we're seeing now. But also we're pumping an awful lot of water out to sea. So there's the energy costs from the internal drainage boards, but it's also all of that water going out to sea whereby we could actually be utilising it back inland. A great example, which I'm sure I've mentioned before, but I'll mention again, is the Felixstowe Hydrocycle, which is a fantastic example whereby we can capture that water, which was gushing out to sea and having a detrimental effect on the salt marshes. So we can capture that water, we can repipe it back inland onto 6 on-farm reservoirs, and it also has an aquifer recharge system as well adjacent to it. So not only are we recharging groundwater, but we're also filling on farm reservoirs, and we're protecting the environmental salt marsh habitat as well.
For those who couldn't get to one of the breakfast meetings, are they able to see the content online anywhere?
There's certainly information on our rural knowledge portal. So if you just Google Savills Rural Knowledge Portal. Additionally, we have a bi-weekly landscape policy update newsletter. So you can subscribe to our information and get that through into your emails.
All right. Kelly Hewson-Fisher from Savills, thanks once again for joining us on the Farming Programme.
No problem.
Lynx FM Farming. Market report.
Starting with livestock from Masons Rural at Louth Market, auctioneer Ed Middleton. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. We're starting off with the prime cattle. Prime heifers this week, all in average 277.8 pence per kilo. And prime steers, all in average 275.5 pence per kilo. Topping the steers this week were J&S Brooks of Strubby at £1,713.95. And topping the heifers were C.A. Mottram and Sons of Lincoln at £1,638 per head. Again, many more prime cattle needed weekly to meet buying demand. A reminder, this coming Monday is store cattle week, so store cattle entries required. And also store cattle entries have been taken for our special store cattle show and sale on Friday the 5th of April. Entry forms are available on the website. Moving swiftly on to the sheep, starting off with the prime hogs. This week we had an SQQ of a staggering 390.56 pence per kilo and an all-in average pounds per head of £181.91. Topping the hogs this week were regular vendors Paul and Ian Tuplin of Skegness at £214, with their run of 40 hogs average a roaring £195.63. Topping the pence per kilo were Scrivelsby Farms Limited of Horncastle at 436 pence per kilo. As ever, many more hogs required. Please give me a call with your entries. Moving on to cull ewes. This week we had an average in the cull ewes of £130.86, with a top price of £190 from G. Smithson of Tupholme. As ever, many more sheep required weekly. Please do not hesitate to give me a call with entries. That concludes this week's market report. I'm Edward Middleton, auctioneer at Louth Livestock Market.
Thanks, Ed. And to the grey markets with some guide prices. Open Fields, Alice Killam. Morning, Alice.
Good morning, Steve. Following a good start to the week, we've seen values just check back. But importantly, we've held on to some of them. With some important reports about to be released, we hope that we can maintain the gap that we've built up from the bottom. Following on from the news earlier in the week around China and their cancellation of wheat they'd purchased from the US, there have also been rumours about cancellation of orders originally bought from Australia and also France. If true, this would certainly hurt the old crop Matif market, but this has been refuted by the French midweek and we have seen this market attempt to recover. Whilst we wait for more solid news, the EU import and export data has not been released this week due to technical issues. What we do know is that those holding the shorts in the market are slowly beginning to get out. With just over 4 months left for the old crop market, it's difficult to see a path that gets us anywhere near the levels that hovered around the 195 mark on futures. We are circa £7 to £8 from the bottom, and the premium of ex-farm wheat to futures has also changed. We can't escape the fact that Black Sea wheat and corn is cheap and is happily taking any demand that appears. And the supply of this, though it has slowed, is still plentiful. They have not run out yet. Attempting to predict the new crop market is, for me, a far harder thing to do. It is true that the reports from the Black Sea suggest that crops look good, and providing there is not a big tail to the winter, there will be a big surplus to export once again. I am sure that most of you, like I, will have heard this before though, and we have read that many farmers in the Ukraine, who up to now have not had to fight, are now being conscripted into the conflict. This alone does raise questions as to how some of the work will be done. What is also true is that the conditions in large parts of the EU are not so good, and crop numbers for next season will be lower. Expensive weather models will attempt to do some of this work, but the weekly drilling progress of the French spring barley crop at just 1% in the whole week is a good illustration that not all is well. Many European eyes will be on the UK with AHDB's release of the early bird report on Friday. I wonder if many realise how bad some of the UK actually is. Clearly, as a bull, we must hope for a shock number, something to move new crop a bit, which in turn would help old. There are further reports around the corner, not least the USDA on the 28th of March as they take a stab at their new crop numbers also. I do believe that we'll get some little opportunities in the next 2 or 3 months. They won't be big, but they will be good days, as Monday and Tuesday have shown us. It's just important that we don't get too ambitious so we don't miss them. For something more fundamental and to shift the fund's focus, we're going to need something a little more dramatic. Time on new crop, maybe not so much on old. Some guide prices of this week, circa Friday morning. Feed wheat, April 160 to 170, November 175 to 185, with Group 1 milling premiums still holding at around £60 to £70. Feed barley for May, 130 to 140, and November 145 to 155. All seed rape, February 350 to 360, and July 360 to 365. As usual, please do call for firm values.
Thanks, Alice.
The Farming Programme. 5-day forecast.
Well, it's a typical mixed early spring week. Mostly dry, mild and calm to start the week. Cooler with some light rain midweek and then reverting to mild and dry towards the weekend. Winds, such as they are, mostly south to southwest. Next week, rural crime and organised crime and announcements from two of the regulars on the Farming Programme. The Week in Agriculture. The next podcast will go live Sunday morning from 7. Of course, you can subscribe on all podcast platforms so you don't miss an episode, or you could listen on the Lynx FM app. I'm Steve Orchard. Until then, have a great week.
The Farming Programme with Arroquip Steel Stockholders, Withambrook Industrial Estate Grantham. BSI ISO 9001 accredited.